Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today's show is truly extraordinary. It is the first part of an interview that I did with centenarian Norman Corwin. Centenarian, that means he was 100 and change when I interviewed him. He will be 101 May of this year, 2011. This is an extraordinary story, not only because Norman has managed to outlive almost everyone, but because his life parallels the creation of the radio, and he has been a major player as a writer in every form, every media that there possibly is. He was the most important writer in radio, and his radio plays during World War II are still archived and listened to by anyone who wants to know anything about what that time in our history was like. So this is an extraordinary event. It was for me, certainly, and I hope it will be for you. So, hang on. Here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about demonstrating the real you, being the person you really are, you, me, everyone. If you've heard the show before, you've heard me say over and over that I believe that we learn early in our lives to dissemble, to spin, to pretend, to deny aspects of ourselves, and that in a lot of instances, some of the things which we decide we have to forfeit, we have to jettison, are things which actually we really need, and in many cases which are really important to and for us. But they somehow didn't fit with our family of origin, or with the school that we were in, or someplace we learned, don't do that, don't be that. Actually, don't do that would be okay. We learned, don't be that. Because don't do that, you can pretend, but still remember what you are. But don't be that, that suggests you had better hide that. And we human beings are remarkably facile and are quite able to hide. And so we do. We hide those parts of ourselves which, for one reason or another, we decided, even sometimes when we were wrong, that it didn't fit, didn't go down well, caused us to be embarrassed, neglected, ostracized, even punished, teased. So we pretended not to be that. And we got so good at the pretense that we forgot that we were it. And so we come into adulthood not on all four burners, to use a very old analogy. It is my belief as a psychotherapist that we need all of who we are. At the very least, we need not to be pretending stuff we're not. Even if it is qualities that we would prefer not to have, the energy that we have to spend in suppressing it, pretending it, steals from us the energy that we would otherwise be using to live. So, in my view, it is best to be all that you can be, to quote the army. Although, I don't think this is what they had in mind, since they are clearly not about having everybody be what they can be, or they wouldn't have Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Okay, I never speak political things. I'm very sorry to have brought that up. However, I do agree with the army in that we all ought to be all that we can be, all that we are, never mind can be. Just being all that we are is enough. So this show is about pointing out the fact that most of us, I think probably all of us, have been forced to hide something. And it's my hope that this show encourages you to ask yourself, what is it that I might be hiding that I could use? What energy could I be releasing so that I could have more access to myself? And then, if you can think of it, to begin to imagine what it would be like to have that back. And in many of the shows, I talk about how you do that. What are the obstacles to that? What are the price for that? Because there is. But I also interview, as part of my interview series, Anatomy of an Artist, I play interviews that I've done with people who make their living or their life within art. And I do that because, unfortunately, we are so inhospitable to artists in our culture, unless they're screamingly famous, make a lot of money, or create a lot of gossip. But to the run-of-the-mill artist, people who simply want to do an art for its own sake, we're not particularly encouraging. So, if you have given your life to an art, it's really because you have had no choice. It is really who you are. And when you hear the interviews that I do with people who have made a living or a life with an art, you hear what we therapists call congruence, that they are who they are. Today, I'm playing the first half of an interview with perhaps the most remarkable person I have interviewed in my 3 years of doing this. This is Norman Corwin. And one of the things that's really remarkable about Norman is that I've mentioned this interview to many people and no one had ever heard of him. And as I have listened to his interview, I find this stunning, impossible. I can't even think of a word of how amazingly bizarre it is that really well-educated people have not heard of Norman Corwin. So if you have not heard of Norman Corwin, don't feel bad. Lots of people haven't. Norman Corwin, as I said in my lead-in, and if you got my email, you heard, he will be 101 on May 3rd in this year, 2011. And he began his career in a little newspaper in a New England town at 19 and rapidly got into radio. You'll hear this story. It's adorable. He got a little 15 minutes in an evening doing a poetry show, and they told him that there was no fee for it, and he said the price was right. And as he said, his career is a series of accidents leading to accidents leading to accidents, and they're funny. They're funny, but they wind up with him writing radio plays for CBS, the very beginning of radio, and literally changing the face of what might have been radio. They hired him to produce. They didn't know he could write. I'm not even sure Norman knew he could write write radio plays when he first got that job. But his very first radio play, The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, caused Edgar R. Murrow to come to his office, beginning a lifelong friendship and joint career. They produced a lot of stuff together. But this is only one of the amazing aspects of Norman's career. His radio plays, beginning at the beginning of World War II and all the way through, are historical archives. They are, in fact, archived. If you want to know anything about what it was like, what people were hearing, thinking, feeling during World War II, you want to hear Norman Corwin's radio plays. I'm not going to tell too much of the story because you'll hear it from Norman. But he used everybody that there was, every famous star. I don't want to tell any more of the story. But I will just say that he went on. World War II was over. Radio was launched. Norman went on to write for the screen. He went on to write plays. He went on to write movies and books, and many are written about him. And as you hear at the very beginning, he says he's still at 100 years old, writer in residence at USC, even though he can't quite be in residence because he's stuck in a wheelchair. But he's still writing. So I hope that this interview will be heard by lots of people, because lots more people need to know about Norman Corwin. And as I said in the email I sent out, if you go up on my website, I have the radio plays up there. I was going to do them in this interview, but they're too long. So please go up and listen to Orson Welles and Lionel Barrymore and James Stewart and on and on and on and on, speaking Norman Corwin's still very stirring words. And now, although the voice is scratchy and weak, the mind is sharp and the sense of humor is there, This is a remarkable man. So here is the, I don't know, I can't even think of another amazing adjective to describe Norman Corwin.
Okay, I'm here with Norman Corwin, who is a centenarian? How do you say it?
Centenarian.
Yeah. He was 100 May 3rd, and here it is in February, and here he still is.
Longer than I expected.
It is longer than you expected.
Yeah.
You know, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Did you understand me?
Yes, I understood. I am still in the employ at the University of Southern California.
Are you?
Yeah.
And what do you do for them?
I'm a writer in residence. Although, as you see, I don't reside.
That's quite right. You're not actually in residence.
I'm not actually in residence.
So are you writing now?
Yeah.
You've been writing all your life?
I more or less, yeah.
Do you remember how you started to write? Why you started to write?
Yes.
You do? Could you tell me?
I was in the fourth grade of grammar school when the teacher assigned a book review. And I didn't know quite, wasn't sure what a book was. But there was a copy, a library copy of The Black Cat by Edgar Allan Poe around, and I reviewed that. And my teacher thought it so wonderful that a youngster would read Poe that she had me stand up and reading my piece to the class. And I was hoax, line, and sinker.
Sinker, right.
Ahem.
So what you were hooked on was the how much they liked it and that?
Well, I was a ham. I was reading from my writing to the class.
Uh-huh.
And that brought out the ham in me.
Yes, yes.
And I you employed the word ever since.
So then, did you start writing then, or did you...
I kept on writing.
What did you write when you were a boy?
I wrote a World War I novel.
Really?
An old thrift book that I was lying around, and I illustrated that story with the drawing, and you must believe me when I say it was terrible.
I believe you, but who cares, right?
Well, it gave my aunts something to laugh at night, and I thought I was a great success.
So you kept getting encouragement.
Yes.
Yes. Did anybody else in your family write?
I had two brothers, and all three of us were imported, worked at the same time on different newspapers.
Really?
In New England.
Okay. So, all right. So now you're a boy, and you've discovered that you can write, and that this writing gets people's attention. Right?
Yeah. My father indulged helped me by encouraged me by buying me a typewriter. And the typewriter was a Hammond, and it was an early version of a typewriter that was released much later to the world, where the alphabet was distributed over a globe.
Over a globe?
Yeah.
A typewriter where the letters are on a globe? Good grief.
Yeah.
That's what you learned to type on?
That's right.
Wow.
I enjoyed that typewriter immensely. And it was an extraordinary instrument. Even today, ahead of its time, even today, they don't have many with that mechanism?
No, I've never seen one.
It's HAMMOND.
Like the organ.
Yeah, like the organ.
Mm-hmm. So your father thought you had some talent, so he got you a typewriter?
Yeah. And I showed off my ability to read print by reading the Boston Globe to my family. And they were impressed.
More hamming.
I said they were.
Right?
Yeah, I was hamming.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But they liked it, or they encouraged you, right?
They encouraged me.
So right at the beginning, you got the idea that writing was a good thing, and
yes,
that it would bring you attention.
And when I came time to go to college,
mm-hmm,
I wanted to go to Harvard, but I had no Latin, and to go to Harvard, one required at that time a knowledge of Latin.
So what did you do?
Instead, I left home.
So you didn't go to school?
No.
Oh my.
My college consisted of newspaper work.
So you started to work right away?
Yeah.
Did your family mind?
If they did, they didn't protest.
They supported you no matter what.
They supported me.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you couldn't get into Harvard because you didn't have Latin, so you went off to work at a newspaper.
Yeah, that was my liberal arts course.
That was your liberal arts course. I love it. I bet you learned everything there was to learn there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then that's your first work, is at a newspaper?
Huh?
That's your first work, is at a newspaper?
Yes.
And so then how did the rest of it happen?
Accident led to accident led to accident.
I believe you. Can you tell me some of the accidents?
Interviewing a man on radio who was a self-proclaimed ashcan roller. He could roll a barrel full of ashes faster and farther without spilling an ash than anybody else. And he proclaimed, he came to the newspaper where I was in charge of nuts. And they were referred to me because I was a color writer from the beginning.
What's a color writer?
You write about the weather and...
So like soft stuff, not hard news and stuff.
That's right. Well, you could experiment a little.
You could experiment. So they sent you this ash can roller.
Yes, ash can roller. And I praised him as the world's champion of ash can rolling. Well, the New York columnists got hold of my espousal of ashcan rolling, and they had a field trip with the H.I.O. McIntyre was then a popular columnist, and invented a character who had won the World Ashcan Rolling title in Omsk, Siberia. And I had a lot of fun with that. until my Ashkenroller was challenged locally by a man who painted his Ashken red, white, and blue. And my men, I arranged for a meeting of the two, which I promoted on the front page of the Bible of Western Massachusetts, which was a paper, a newspaper that had some standing as a preparation for New York journalism.
And, so and, did your guy win?
Huh?
Did your guy win?
Yes, he won, but in the course of which I was asked to interview him for radio. And I encouraged this poor bastard. He was a very sweet man who worked for the Street Cleaning Department of Springfield, Massachusetts. And he came to me after a dry period, and he complained that nobody was paying attention to him or his art. And
You promoted him.
I promoted him. I wrote a letter applying for permission to roll an ash can full of ashes in Times Square to introduce the sport to America. And I wrote in behalf of this man. And the Associated Press got hold of it. And I remember I was then working for the Springfield Republican. And I remember a man rushing out from the office where we had a newspaper printer. And it had a story about my letter having been reached the street cleaning department of Times Square, which referred it to another street cleaning department. And the columnists went crazy with this story. And part of the craze was my interviewing the Ashkenroller himself, who barely spoke English.
Oh my.
He was Italian. And I interviewed him at a time when newspapers were worried about a thing called radio, because they were afraid it would put
them out of business.
Put them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
The facet of journalism opened by radio was terribly new, and most papers were hostile to the new medium, not the Springfield Republican. It was not a Republican paper, but it called itself the Republican. It was a good paper, was liberal, and was the only paper in the state which defended Secco and Vanzetti.
Really?
Yeah. And I did the interview, and when the radio came along mightily, I was made radio editor on the basis of my interview.
What does the radio editor do?
Ran a radio page, and I made a good one of it. I had something called What to Find, Where to Find What You Want When You Want It. And it was a convenience to which the public was not yet accustomed. And the station, this is in Springfield, Massachusetts, but they had a station or a Westinghouse connection with WVC in Boston. Both were owned, they were in synchronization.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to become a radio editor on the basis of my being the first to interview anybody on radio.
Oh, God.
And that got me started.
You were the first to interview anyone on radio.
Yeah.
And it was this ash can roller.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it got you yet again attention, right?
That's right. That's right.
And so when did you start writing plays?
Much later.
Really? So what happened after that then?
I worked in Springfield for 10 years, 7 years, and then I had a brother, the same who was going to be scheduled to be 108 on April 28. He was working for NBC in New York, and he called me one day and said, there's a job open in the publicity department of 20th Century Fox. I want you to come down and take that job because you need New York. And I said, but I have a date tonight. And my brother said, you be here.
Wow. He said, you need New York?
Yeah.
That's great.
And so I went to New York, and he wrote publicity for the home office of 20th Century Fox, which then is now has a home office in New York.
I didn't know that.
And I enjoyed that. And while there, I wrote a letter to W2XR, which was the only station in the world that had a number of its call letters, 2. And when the New York Times bought it, they changed the 2.
To Q.
To Q.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you wrote a letter to W2XR. What did you say?
I said, you broadcast all of the arts except the oldest of them, which is poetry.
Wow.
And you should know that the first poem in English still applies, and that was Somewhere is a Coming In, Load Sing Cuckoo.
What? Say it again.
Summer.
Summer?
Is it coming in?
Is it coming in?
Loud sing.
Loud sing. The cuckoo.
The cuckoo. or blazeth the ewe bleats.
The ewe bleats.
V-I-E-H-S.
Yeah, I know.
And you should have a poetry program. And they said, would you prepare one for us? And I did. And I went over one lunch hour and presented myself at the invitation of the station. And they liked what they heard and said, how would you like to be on Tuesday night from 9:15 to 9:30? And I said, it's fine. That's fine by me. And they said, of course we can't pay you anything. And I said, the price is right. And I went to work for them.
So now you were still working for Fox during the day and you were doing poetry on Tuesday night?
Yeah.
For W2XR?
W2XR.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not shy about their uniqueness. They called themselves at one time the station for people who hate radio. And I loved that attitude. And I went to work with them. Not all listeners enjoyed my reading of poetry and discussion of it. And I had a relative in New York who fell asleep on one of my programs. And that was my yardstick of success. I decided to introduce poets. I had some Pulitzer Prize poets on the program. There was no outlet for poetry.
Right.
And one time, Edgar Lee Masters.
Edgar Lee Masters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wrote Spoon River
Anthology.
Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with it. And there's a character in Spoon River who was Russian and spoke with a Russian accent.
Mm-hmm.
And whose epitaph is Russian, is anglicized Russian. And my tailor on Broadway was such a character. He could not speak in other than a Russian accent. And I went to him and said, how would you like to be on the radio? He said, what, me? I said, yes, you. And he said, tell me about it. And I told him about it. And he appeared.
As the character in Spoon River? You're kidding, you're Taylor? That's
and the vice president in charge of programming at CBS was ill that night and caught the program. He was tuning around to see what the opposition offered. And he heard my Russian accent and thought, that's a fine director who employs fine actors.
He's thinking of you.
That's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get him in to talk. Uh-huh. And I had a champion at the station at NBC who knew Bob Trout, who was a big announcer at CBS, and he knew Bob's Bob's wife, then to be wife, and sold him the idea of proposing me as a director at CBS. So I was hired to direct programs for radio, and that started me.
Yeah.
I had never written a script before.
Oh my goodness.
A rhyme rule. My first script for CBS was in 1938, and it was all rhymed.
Really?
It was The Plot to Overthrow Christmas.
It was what?
The Plot to Overthrow.
The Plot to Overthrow Christmas. So it must have gone over really well.
It went over wonderfully well. And CBS hired me as a director. Didn't know I could write.
Apparently. Yeah, right. This is like the book review thing. You know? You don't know you can do it, but you do.
But I did it.
This you did. That's exactly right. So then, did they begin to allow you to write? Is that how it got started?
I sold them on the idea of the CBS, the program that I started at W2XR. With fine actors, I didn't have to call on my Broadway tailor.
And I'm assuming that now CBS is actually paying you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Good.
And a considerable advance in salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living with a brother and his wife. And on the west side in Broadway. And I was sure that my life was changed. And I considered having a valet take care of my clothes. But fortunately, I was talked out of that.
So about how old were you when this happened?
About 19. I was away from home. This was Western Massachusetts.
Wait a second. Who did you meet after The Plot to Overthrow Christmas?
Edward R. Murrow.
Oh my goodness.
He came to the door of my office and rapped on it. I opened it, and there stood Murrow. And he was, even then, based in London. This is 1938.
Oh, the war.
Yeah. He and his wife were in New York for the holidays, and they had heard the program, and Ella had to look me up.
Wow.
And that began a lifelong friendship with Ed Murrow, including co-producing with him a series from London. Late in the war.
Late in the war?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I love this man who was killed, as you know.
Yes.
By smoking.
Yes. Yes, I do know. So that story, The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, really launched you.
Yes.
Much as the ash can roller launched you, right? That these are the...
And I followed it a few weeks later with an original program called They Fly Through the Air, and that it attacked the bombing of civilian populations in Spain by the Nazis, because Hitler had ended the Spanish Civil War on the side of Franco. And they had bombed Guernica.
Yes.
As you know.
Yes, Picasso.
And there was a long time a museum painting by Picasso.
Yes.
The bombing of Guernica. And this is at the modern museum for many years.
So, you want to tell me about Orson Welles?
This is a telegram from Orson.
Shall I read it?
Sure.
Doing your show last week was a really great thrill. Please may I do some job or other for you this week on your Bill of Rights program. All best regards, Orson. And this is December 9th, 1941. Oh my God.
Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And Orson was in that production very powerfully, and it was the first all network stations in the country carried it at the suggestion of FDR, who was then president, and it got my picture and the story in Time magazine, and that was the beginning of my radio career.
I thought that would be a good place to interrupt this interview with. That's how he got his radio career launched, by FDR saying everybody in the country has to hear this show. And you hear Norman say that his career was a series of accidents that led to accidents. And I've heard him interviewed in other contexts where he says that his career is a series of serendipities. And I think it's true. I talk about it in the interview in the beginning, the kinds of things that happen when people sort of come along to lead him in a direction. But it's not only his talent, it is his passion. This is a man, you'll hear him talk next week about his love of the language for its own sake. And he's also a patriot. He's a man who feels so deeply his connection to his country. That's a sentiment that is sort of in contention now in our time. But if you listen to Norman's work, you hear it in its most pure form. This is a basically ethical, honorable, and in my view, noble man. And his work, what can I say? His work stands. So in some of the looking around that I've done as I've been working on this, I discovered something else I didn't know, and that is that he was 96, so it was 7 years ago, a documentary was made on the movie On a Note of Triumph, which was his radio play celebrating the end of World War II and was broadcast to 60 million people in August of 1945. And a documentary was made about Norman and that film. I've been looking all over to try to find a copy of either the film or the documentary, and I haven't had a hell of a lot of luck, but I will keep looking. So what does it mean? His radio play, We Hold These Truths, which was broadcast for the first time in 1938, and then 50 years later, and then On a Note of Triumph, which was broadcast for the first time in 45, and then I can't do the math, I'm sorry, in, I don't know, 2005? Oh, maybe I can. That's 60 years or something. So the man's work just goes on, moving people. And he is fortunate enough to have lived long enough to see that his work just remains vital, current, approachable, accessible. How many writers can say it, you know? And then also, of course, and I don't know when this started, he became a professor of writing at USC in California. And as he says at the beginning of this interview, he's still a writer in residence there. My guess is they will keep him a writer in residence there for as long as they possibly can. So, you know, Norman was himself in the fourth grade when he did the book report on the Edgar Allan Poe book, tempting his teacher to get him to read it to the class. And then he was himself when he noticed that he really liked that the class had to listen to his piece and that the teacher approved of it and that he could feel himself becoming a ham, and he really liked it. And then his love of poetry that made him go to this radio station and say, you know, the only art you are not exposing is the oldest art, that of poetry. I mean, he just kept doing what felt right to him. He just kept pursuing himself, essentially. His ideas, his passions, his everything that had meaning to him. And in next week's show, I'll play the rest of the interview, and we'll follow the rest of his career. And you'll hear some more amazing stories and some more serendipities. You know, he's an icon. He's a national treasure, as I have said. I hope that you enjoyed listening to him as much as I enjoyed sitting there with him. So, I realize I haven't said very much about myself or the show or the website or any of that in this show. I got pretty much taken up with Norman. So let me say that this is the Lynn Show, and if you wanted to hear this show again or any other show that I have ever done, you can go up to my website, which is cleverly called thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Be sure not to leave the E out of Lynn in The Lynn Show, because there's another The Lynn Show. And, I mean, you might be interested in that, but you won't be getting, you won't be getting my website. So you can hear the podcasts. Along the side of the website, you'll see a list of categories. We've tried to categorize everything, so there'll be things like, you know, actor, writer, composer, and then there'll be a list describing the concepts in which I'm talking about how you can become who you really are, and also concepts from my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And so the concepts from that are also listed alongside. So if there's any concept that you wanted to look up, you click on it, and the show in which I am talking about it comes up, and you can listen to it and you can download it. Also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I'm a psychotherapist. my entire practice is currently on the telephone. And I wrote an article about that because, again, a lot of people are stunned by the idea that I might do my work on the telephone. A lot of people believe that this work can only be done face-to-face. I obviously do not. And so I wrote an article called Psychotherapy on the Go, and you can download that as well. And I believe you can download the beginning of the book. There's an audio book for When You Can, You Will, and I mean to get the first chapter up there, but I'm pretty sure you can download a little piece of it. Also, there's a CD of mine, which you can listen to little pieces of. So you can find out anything and everything that you might want to know about me. You can write to me. Also, you can follow me on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, and please do comment. Please do go up on one of those things and tell me if you've listened to the show or any of my shows and what you think about them. Tell me if you knew about Norman, if you were one of the few people who actually knew about him and I wasn't talking to you when I made that speech at the beginning of the show. I need also to thank Josh Hackney, who I thank every week as my IT helpmate, who, as I have said before, makes sure that the sound is as good as it can be. I'm hoping that you understand most of what Norman said. I tried to repeat whatever I thought was really not that clear. So I hope you heard everything that you wanted to hear. Not only does Josh fix the sound, but he does everything that I need. He just built me a new computer, and which I'm trying to learn to use. So if you need anything like that, electronics, recording, computer, building, fixing, saving, website, well, no, not website. If you want website, then you want to go to Frank Gomez, who did my website. And you can find both of those guys, not actually on my website, but you can go to my website, thelinshow.com, click on Contact Me or Email Me, and email me, and I will write to you. I will find these guys for you. I will answer your questions, whatever I can do. So as always, I hope that you heard something in the show that you can use, something that you didn't know, perhaps, something you knew that you forgot, something that intrigued you, triggered your imagination, got your blood going, something that will make you go up on the website and listen to Norman Corwin's work, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. All I want, I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime.